Are you cause or effect, Warshawski, the way the bodies are piling up around you?
Two cops are dead. What's the gossip on the street? Who knows what?
Today on KPR Presents, the return of detectives V.I. Warshawski and Pete Stone. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we'll hear from mystery writer Sarah Paretsky in her book Fallout, Detective V.I. Warshawski Travels to Kansas. But first, Wichita Detective Pete Stone returns in Shadow of Death. It's the second Pete Stone book by Emporia author Michael D. Graves.
I returned to the scene of the crime to conduct my own investigation. I posed as a police detective and knocked on doors and asked questions. Mac would have had my butt in a sling had he known, but it was worth the risk. I had to do something. No one in the neighborhood had anything helpful to offer. They all told the same story. No one had seen anything. No one had heard anything. That's what they told me. Well, someone knew something, I was sure of that. Someone always knew something, an invisible someone who lurked in the shadows and watched. If no one witnessed the crime, someone heard something. A snippet of conversation here, a word or two spoken there, someone who paid attention, who added two and two and came up with four. Such a person held the answers and might share those answers if the price was right, if someone stood to gain from it. I had to find that person.
That's Mike Graves reading from his newest book. Mike, it is great to have you in the KPR studios today.
Thank you, Kay. It's good to be here.
Mike, I first met you and Pete Stone, our detective, in 2016 in your first Pete Stone book, To Leave a Shadow. And at the time, I described him as a hard-boiled, hard-drinking gumshoe in the mold of Philip Marlowe and Mike Hammer. Just remind us briefly, who is Pete Stone?
Well, thank you. Yes, and certainly those names you mentioned are influences on my writing. But Pete Stone actually was inspired by my grandfather, who was not a detective. He was just due to geography and time. He was my paternal grandfather, who I really didn't know well. And so I decided to make up a story about him. He lived in Wichita during 1937, during those years. And so I just decided that I enjoyed writing and reading detective novels, and I thought I would make him a detective. He appeared, as you mentioned, in To Leave a Shadow, which was published in 2015. And now he's come back in Shadow of Death. And this one is a little bit different. The book begins, and I'm not going to spoil too much, but the book does begin with Pete Stone being accused of killing a cop. And the story develops from there. The first mystery was a crime committed primarily for jealousy. A great deal of betrayal was involved. In this particular story, which is totally different, it's not a sequel, this particular story also includes betrayal, but it is driven more by revenge and greed than the first story was.
One of the things that I love about this book, as well as your previous Pete Stone book, To Leave a Shadow, is how you draw in the setting. The book is set in Wichita in the 1930s, and throughout the whole book, there are all kinds of wonderful nods to Wichita history. I want to throw out a couple that just that rang true to me.
Sure.
Pete Stone takes a lady friend out on their first date to White Castle.
To White Castle, which was in fact the first White Castle in America, just a couple of blocks north of the police station where she works. So that was kind of fun. And a lot of this came about just sort of trolling around on the internet and finding there's some wonderful pictures of Wichita in that era. And also it's another nod to my father, who was a great fan of White Castle. He introduced me to White Castles when I was a young lad. And so I had a lot of fun with that. I had to go back and rewrite that passage you're talking about because I initially had them come into the restaurant, set at a table, and a waitress came over and one thing, just like you would in a normal restaurant. But as I looked into this a little closer, I discovered that the first White Castle had a countertop, five stools, and you sat in one of the stools, and that was it. And so I had to go back and rewrite that to make it more authentic.
You know that he's going to be a big spender when he starts out your relationship at White Castle. Another nod to Wichita history, the Wichita Watermen.
Wichita Watermen with local baseball team. I love baseball. I try to bring baseball into everything I write. And the Watermen, that came about, quite frankly, from scanning over microfilm copies of the Wichita Eagle. I wasn't familiar, especially with the team. I knew we had baseball back then. And what is now Lawrence Dumont Stadium was known as Lawrence Stadium in 1937. And the Watermen were a local team. And I especially enjoyed the fact in reading some of the stories that they played teams from other towns. But in 1937, they also played what they called the colored or the Negro teams. In particular, I read about one who came up from a team that came up from Oklahoma. So I thought that was years before Jackie Robinson, and I was glad to read that.
Another Wichita reference. Tell me about Storrs Beer.
Storrs Beer, that came about. There's a little sandwich shop. I hope I can name this in Wichita, near. It's on Seneca, just south of Central, and today it's called Merle's Place. And I was in Merle's Place, my wife and I were, having a sandwich, and they have a nice little newsletter that talked about the history. That used to be Tom's Inn. And they have a wonderful old mahogany bar in there, and that was provided by Storrs Beer, S-T-O-R-Z. Storrs Beer would do this for these little taverns. They would put the bar in if you poured Storrs Beer. And so that's how Tom's came to be.
How about the Little Blue Books?
Little Blue Books were published in Girard, Kansas, and that is also factual. A number of titles. They were very inexpensive. Some of them were on various topics, both fiction and nonfiction. Some of them were quite sophisticated, I guess. I have never seen one. I have never held one. I've only read about them. But they were cheap. You could buy one. I picture it as being almost like the blue books we used to take tests in, and something you could fold up, put in your back pocket, and have something to read.
One last nod to Wichita history, the Jones Motor Car Company.
Jones Motor Car Company. That existed for only about a decade. And Pete Stone does drive a Jones Roadster from about the late teens until into the late 20s. The car company existed. It was a beautiful little car. I only came across this when my wife and I were visiting the Sedgwick County Museum in Wichita, and they have one on display there. And then we went to a car show, and there is a gentleman somewhere from outside of Kansas who owns about six or seven. There are only eight or nine of these cars, from what I understand, even in existence. And he's trying to collect all of them. So it was a beautiful little local car company that existed through those years. But then, unfortunately, a fire burned their business out, and they went out of business.
In Shadow of Death, Pete Stone, he usually works alone, but in this book, he takes on kind of an apprentice in the guise of a young African-American man, Ralph Waldo. Talk to me about that and how unusual that would have been for a private detective, or really for any kind of white businessman, to take on an African-American employee in such a big role.
Thank you for asking. I think it was very unusual. I know that in my family, I was taught at an early age. We lived in the South for some years, and I was taught at an early age that we were all created equal. And so I wanted to at least show that side of my grandfather. And it was unusual. Ralph Waldo's father is Ellis Waldo, who in both of the books, he's introduced and shown as being a very well-educated but self-educated man. He didn't have much formal schooling. But Ellis Waldo learned early in his life that if he learned how to read, he could be just as smart as he wanted to be. And so he does. He's well-read. Pete Stone often leans on him for insight into some of the clues that he's tracking. And Ellis Waldo is a very, not only smart, but a wise man. Ralph Waldo is Ellis's son. So it's a slight play on words, but I do use Ralph Waldo, Ellis's son, and in this role, he plays the role of an invisible man. He is not a licensed private detective, but Pete Stone knows he has to go into what the black or the Negro neighborhood to follow the leads, and doors are going to be slammed in his face because he is a white man. And so Ralph Waldo is hesitant to help him because he is black. He says, I can't go through the same doors you go through. And Pete Stone reminds him, you're exactly right, but I can't go through the doors you go through. So he takes him on. We'll call it an apprentice. I think that's a good word. He's not licensed. He's not carrying a gun. He's not acting as a private detective. But he plays a major role in solving the mystery in Shadow of Death.
Pete's investigation takes him out of Wichita down to Hot Springs, Arkansas. Mike, why Hot Springs?
That was done for fun. My wife and I have been down there more than once. We love to go to Hot Springs. We love to stay in the Arlington Hotel, which has a long, long history. But we can still see signs where there are doors down there that white people go through and black people don't. And so I thought, why not bring that history in? It's a beautiful community. It's a beautiful town. But I wanted to bring in some of that backstory. I also like Hot Springs because Hot Springs was the place where we first had spring baseball. That's the early baseball teams practiced, warmed up in Hot Springs. They talk about Babe Ruth going down there and how he trained. And I think when I look at the number of bars and the number of places that we were told used to be houses of ill repute, I can see where Babe Ruth probably did work out down there. But I'm not sure what kind of shape he got into. But it has a long history. And so I thought, why not have Ralph, who's always looking to improve himself, he ends up, due to circumstances that I won't explain now, he ends up in Hot Springs and Pete goes looking for him.
On his travels down to Arkansas, Pete Stone stops along the way and listens to a lot of jazz.
He does. He loves jazz. He loves barbecue. The jazz that I use in the book is also, I'm not a student of jazz. I enjoy it. I especially enjoy blues. But one of my good friends and good writing inspirations is Kevin Rabus. And Kevin Rabus is not only a very good writer and poet, he is currently our state's poet laureate. And he helps not only me, but many, many writers with inspiration and with ideas. And so I decided to use him. This is sort of a, I hope I don't embarrass Kevin, but he's a good guy. When Pete is in Hot Springs, he goes to a bar down there that did exist during that time. And there's a jazz trio playing. It's the Ivana Curbs Trio. And Ivana Curbs is just an anagram for Kevin Rabus. So I wanted to just include that as just a little nod to Kevin. Kevin, if you're listening, I love you, buddy.
That's great. I never picked up on that.
Well, so a lot of these little word games I know I'm doing that I don't expect the reader to know or pick up on these. So sometimes it's just for fun.
That's great. And not only is Kevin our state poet laureate, and as you said, a poet and a writer, he's a jazz poet.
He is a jazz poet. He's my favorite jazz drummer.
Going back to Pete Stone's temperament, he describes himself at one place as more stubborn than brilliant. And I loved that characterization of him as a person, as well as sort of a self-awareness about his strengths and his weaknesses.
I did that for more than one reason, I guess. although I love mystery stories, I love detective stories, I'm not a detective. I couldn't really make him a detective. It's not my background. And so I wanted to include in my grandfather and my father. I knew my father, of course, much better, but they were stubborn. If they had something that had to be done, they would make sure that they got it done no matter what they had to do. So Pete Stone does describe himself as that. He just won't give up. And Lieutenant McCormick is aware of this. They have a love-hate relationship. Thaddeus McCormick was the real name of one of my dad's favorite uncles. And my dad's middle name was Thaddeus. So that's where he comes from. And I picture him somewhat going nose to nose with Pete Stone, but it's a relationship where they both respect and admire each other. And he knows Pete is going to get in the way, but he knows he's going to help in the long run. And so he pretends to be gruff. He pretends to stay out of the detective business. Don't bother the police, but they do. It's a symbiotic relationship. They help each other. They feed on each other, and they need each other. So we have Lieutenant McCormick, who does this for the city for a living, and then we have Pete Stone, who does it also for a living, but with his stubbornness and tenacity, he has really more of the time and the resources to attack one of these mysteries than perhaps the police themselves would.
Like your previous story, To Leave a Shadow, in this book, Shadow of Death, another one of the plot lines involves Pete Stone and his relationship with the women in his life, whether it be his office mate or romantic relationship.
Right.
Bring us up to date on that.
Okay. Thank you for asking that also. In the first book, we ended with Pete having solved the mystery of Lucille Hamilton's husband's death. This is not a spoiler. That was that happened early in the book. So Lucille Hamilton is truly his love. And the reason for that is that my grandfather Pete was married to Lucille. So I eventually have to get them back together. They don't quite get that done in the second book. At the time, Lucille is feeling betrayed, rightfully so, not betrayed by Pete, but betrayed by men in general. She's just cautious. Pete, on the other hand, is a bulldog and a bulldozer, and he wants the relationship to move forward. So they're at odds at the beginning of the book. By the end of the book, Pete has also been betrayed, not by Lucille, but he has been betrayed, and so the relationship is still in limbo. The relationship with Agnes, his secretary, developed in the first book, and it looked like there might be a romance there, but they realized early on Agnes had lost her job. She needed work. Pete knew she would be wonderful in the office, and I certainly didn't want to have an office romance. So they agreed to treat each other with respect, arm's length, and that's their relationship. Pete likes women, but he doesn't use women. He respects and admires women, and they usually find him strong, and they usually find that they admire what his character, probably more than their job. At some point, he will get with Lucille, but I suspect that will signal the end of Pete's detective life, so I'm not sure exactly when that's going to happen yet.
So we've got some more Pete Stone stories yet to come.
I'm working on one now. It's in the early stages. And I, since I mentioned earlier that I am not a detective, I have taught and I've enjoyed. I recently retired from Emporia State University, had a wonderful career teaching at the university, international students. And so the next book that I'm working on will spend more than a little time at what is now Wichita State University. Back then it was known as the Municipal or City of Wichita University. And so so I'm bringing in some of those aspects of life that I am familiar and comfortable with.
Mike, you just mentioned your recent retirement from Emporia State University.
Yes.
What do you think your students brought to you in terms of being not just a professor, but an author? What did you take away from your university experience when it came to writing this and other works?
That's a wonderful question. And I've tried to remind my students often of this. I don't know if I got it across or not, but there was never a time when I was a teacher that I didn't feel I was learning as much as I was teaching. Never a time. I was very fortunate in knowing hundreds of students from around the world, China, South Korea, Japan, Saudi Arabia, a number of African countries, and there was such a rich exchange of ideas, cultures, and lifestyles that I think helped me tremendously as I'm writing, just as I go even through our country, just to see how people are open or not open to new ideas and new ways of looking at things. So I think the openness to the cultures and the ideas, I think, really helped me a lot.
Mike, can I get you to read another excerpt from Shadow of Death?
I'd love to. Let's see here. This is where Pete Stone finds Ralph Waldo, and he's trying to convince Ralph Waldo to come on board with him. He needs his help. Ralph is reluctant, and so this is just a brief dialogue between Ralph and Pete. This is Pete speaking. "I want you to work undercover. I want to know what's being talked about on the street," I said. "Two cops are dead. The police may have a suspect, but maybe they don't. Maybe they're groping too. Either way, I'd like to know what's going on. Who's being questioned and why? What's the gossip on the street? Somebody knows something. Who has the information? Who knows what?" "I thought detectives followed clues," Ralph said. "They do when they have them. First, we need to find a clue. I have a hunch that there is a connection between the two victims. I don't know what that connection might be, but I intend to find out." "That sounds vague," he said. I nodded agreement. "That's why they call it detecting," I said. "I spend a lot more time looking for something than I do finding it. Most of what I do is fruitless and a waste of time. The trouble is, I never know when my efforts will bear fruit until they do. I just peek into corners and peer into shadows until something takes shape. Sometimes it never does. There are no guarantees in this business, Ralph. Do you still want to try it?" "Count me in," he said. "Where should I start?"
That's Mike Graves reading from his latest book, Shadow of Death. Mike, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Just ahead, Detective V.I. Warshawski leaves Chicago and comes to Kansas. My conversation with author Sarah Paretsky coming up right after this. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. While you're there, check out Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War. It's a statewide oral history project featuring Kansans who served in Vietnam. You can find last week's KPR Presents, along with photographs and interview excerpts, at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Lawrence Taekwondo, providing instruction for men, women, and children in the legacy of traditional martial arts. Located at 1846 Vermont Street across from Cordley Elementary or online at lawrencetaekwondo.com.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, Detective V.I. Warshawski comes to Kansas. Sarah Paretsky is the author of the best-selling V.I. Warshawski Detective Series. This interview was originally broadcast on KPR Presents on March 25th, 2018. Let's start with a quick plot overview. V.I. takes on a missing persons case that starts in a suburban Chicago gym. It involves a young filmmaker and an elderly former actress, and brings them to Fort Riley and then to Lawrence. No spoilers here, but can you take it from there?
The reason that the book is set in Kansas, and this is not a spoiler because it ends up not playing a serious role in the story, but my dad was a cell biologist on the Hill and did that for his entire professional career from 1951 until he died, really, in 2000. And in the 60s and 70s, during the Cold War, some of his research really was on the fringes of biological warfare. He worked with an organism that was similar to what the Soviets were trying to weaponize. They were trying to weaponize the organism that causes typhus, and the one that he worked on causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So he went to a big conference. He had wanted to study their strain of it, and of course they were never going to let an American scientist look at what they were doing. But he went to a big conference in Czechoslovakia in the 60s, and he somehow persuaded one of the technicians in the Czech bioweapons lab to inject him with the strain of their organism. And he came back to Kansas City. He got off the plane with a fever of 104. He didn't start antibiotics until his lab tech had come and taken a blood sample from him so that he could culture it. I want to say that people on the TWA flight that he was on were not at risk because it's transmitted by fleas or ticks, not directly person to person. So unless the plane was filled with fleas and ticks, everyone else was safe. But that episode, I never knew why he did it. I don't know whether really the U.S. Army put pressure on him to try to bring it back, whether it was just his sort of stubborn determination to study it, or he was in many ways a, let's just say, very unusual person who had no use for authority in any form. And it may have just been that he wanted to prove that he could thumb his nose at the entire Soviet military and police apparatus and smuggle this thing out under their very noses. So I'll never know. But when I started thinking about a book that might have something to do with bioweapons, which this book in some ways does, but it had to be set in Kansas because I couldn't imagine anything with that kind of work anywhere else. I mean, it could have taken place anywhere in the country, I suppose, but to me, its home was here in Kansas on the Hill. So I had to get VI out of Chicago, and that led to the missing actress, who's an African-American woman in her late 70s, maybe early 80s. And that also gave me... I hadn't started the story meaning to do that, but it gave me a chance to explore my perspective on race relations in Lawrence, which I didn't know much about when I was growing up, but I've learned more about since moving away.
This is your 18th V.I. Warshawski novel, but the first in which she travels to Kansas. Why did it take so long to get V.I. to your old stomping grounds?
I don't think I ever thought of her as operating in Kansas. And I originally was imagining this book more as a standalone novel without her. I had done one standalone, Bleeding Kansas, that I published 8 or 9 years ago. And I kind of wanted to write more about this part of the world just because I think as I get older, I don't know that it's nostalgia necessarily, but as you get older and you look at the arc of your life, your earliest experiences begin to take a certain shape and become more what you want to look at and study, maybe. But I couldn't persuade my publishers or my agent that a standalone novel would sell any copies. And I'm not a huge risk taker with my career. I need to make a living, and so when no one would give me a contract for the standalone novel, I decided I would figure out a way to get VI here.
You'd mentioned your previous book, Bleeding Kansas, which I had the pleasure of interviewing you back in 2008 about that book. In what way was it different for you writing about Kansas for VI versus if it had been some other protagonist?
That's a really good question, Kay. I think that in some ways it would have been harder and easier. Harder because VI is so much part of my own skin and bones, so to speak, that I won't say this was an easy book to write. I've written 20 novels, and only the fourth was easy to write. But her voice and her take on the world are just second nature to me. It's like putting on your most favorite pair of shoes that look nice, but you can really walk around in. I don't have that pair of shoes, but I mythically in my fantasy life.
All have that pair of shoes in our imagination.
But it was harder also because I think of Lawrence and I think of Chicago in two very different ways. And Chicago's been my home for 50 years, but it's 50 adult years. Lawrence was my home for my first 20 years, my coming of age years. I went to Caw Valley District 95, a two-room school, and I'm not sure what they're doing with it now. For a while, it was some fancy prep school, but it's something else now. And then I went to Lawrence High and did my undergraduate degree at KU. So it's in some ways, my sort of patriotic sense of place is really Lawrence, and it's really Kansas, despite the many problems and issues that I know Kansas and Lawrence and the university all face. So it was hard to bring in an outsider from the big city, and I took me a number of months, probably 3 or 4 months of working on the novel before I really felt that she belonged in this space. I think in a way, she comes to Fort Riley first because the actress that she's looking for, Emerald Faring, Emerald was born there. Her father was with the 1st Infantry, which is stationed at Fort Riley, and he was shipped out and died at the Battle of the Bulge. She was born there while he was already dead. So I had VI stop there to try to find information about her. One of the things, the flood of 1951, the great flood that anybody who's older, my age or older, remembers, I didn't realize until I was doing research, it displaced a quarter of the Kansas population. It just staggered me, and it completely obliterated all of the barracks at Fort Riley. So the fort was totally rebuilt from ground up after the flood. So I got obsessed with it for a while. I was consulting old maps and trying to get information from the War College in Fort Leavenworth and so on. I wanted to know whether housing for African American soldiers had been segregated. It didn't seem to me that it was, although I sort of also couldn't believe that it wasn't. But I never could really get that information. But none of that exists anymore. None of the housing that would have stood in the 40s is there in Fort Riley anymore.
You just mentioned that although you grew up in Lawrence, you've lived in Chicago for 50 years. I'm wondering if some of VI's observations about Kansas and Lawrence reflect your own observations when you come back home from the big city.
One of the things that VI notices is the ubiquitous Jayhawk, and I put that in as a marker, just because that Jayhawk is everywhere. But what can I say? I love the Jayhawk. My brothers and I, we were half joking when our dad died, and he was very dedicated to KU. We thought, could we get the baby Jay to come to his funeral and do a few tricks? But we decided the rest of the extended family might not find that as cherished a moment as we would. But I think some of the way that VI looks at Lawrence is like the flip side of the way I look at Chicago, because I came to Chicago as an outsider, and I saw things that people who grew up there don't really ever see. I mean, some of it's banal details, like you ride the elevated trains in Chicago and you see wildlife, you see foxes, you see pheasants, and I don't think people really look out the windows and look at it, but it all was startling to me, or drunks asleep on the roof. That was all just part of the urban experience that natives are inured to and don't really notice. And so VI comes to Lawrence, and she notices the homeless people, which actually I find very shocking here, because that wasn't part of the town when I was growing up and when I left, but it definitely is now part of the Lawrence landscape.
Much of the book is set in Lawrence, but you acknowledge in your introduction that you've taken some liberties with the town and its geography. In what way does VI's Lawrence look different than our Lawrence?
I've created a United Church, a Congregational Presbyterian Church, on the banks of the Kaw, and I've inserted that. If you go down Kentucky Street to where it bends and turns west, I've added some land there up on the bluff, and it's a church. I actually created it in Bleeding, Kansas, and didn't really think through the geography when I created it for Bleeding, Kansas. This book, I spent a lot of time just hiking around, and my brother Jonathan, who still lives here, we drove around. There's a part of the book where a truck goes into the Wakarusa River, and Google Maps does not show you how that might be possible. In fact, you think it might be impossible, and I wrote a whole bunch of chapters about that, and then I came here, and Jonathan took me out, and we actually hiked down there, and I had to rewrite all that because I'd just gotten every detail wrong. Message there for writers who think they can do all their research online. No, when you are writing about the Antarctic, you must go to the Antarctic, because otherwise people who live and work there will tell you all the mistakes you made. So that was one thing. And then I added a missile silo to Douglas County, the Kanwaka missile silo. And I put that, my family lived out east on 15th Street. We were actually in the Eudora Township. We're not far from Pendleton's Country Market, which many listeners I'm sure know. So I've added about a quarter mile land in between the Pendletons and the next farm, and then stretched the distance a little bit to K-10, between old K-10 and new K-10, and I've put this missile silo in there. And that was another fascinating thing for me with the research that I did for this book, was all these, I mean, we all knew we were expendable growing up in the 50s and 60s, that they put the missile silos where there weren't a lot of people, and in Kansas, along with the rest of the Midwest, is dotted with them. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, they don't care if we're fried, because there are not a lot of us and we don't count. And it just always kind of made me grow up feeling a little belligerent about my value to the United States. But many of these silos, after President Reagan and Premier Gorbachev made their historic weapons disarmament agreement in, now I can't remember the year, but in the 80s, many of these missiles were decommissioned. The nuclear warheads were taken out and taken apart and taken down to their components and hopefully stored someplace safe. But the empty silos now, many of them have turned into meth labs. And that's one of the things that people wonder if that's happening in the Kanwaka silo that I've plunked in Douglas County. But some of them have been turned into these survivalist condos, which it just leaves me scratching my head. Like, you can buy for about $1.5 million to $2 million, you can buy a condo underground that will supposedly, I mean, I guess it would get you through a nuclear attack, because the silos were built to withstand an incoming missile from the Soviet side. But oh man, who wants to be there underground? But they feature imported granite countertops made in Germany. You get a 5-year free supply of freeze-dried food with your purchase of this condo. And the part that just leaves me really scratching my head, or actually guffawing, is that there's guaranteed Wi-Fi. And I'm thinking, right, after Armageddon, the internet will still be up and running. Who really believes that? But I guess the person who wants to spend $1.5 million on an underground condo. So there's a good business to go into, I guess, is buying old missile silos from the government with it going cheap and turning them into expensive survivalist condos.
You can keep that in mind just in case this book thing doesn't work out for you.
Right, I know.
There are so many local references in Fallout. You mentioned the big flood of 1951, the filming of the movie The Day After here in Lawrence in 1983, street names and local landmarks. There's even a clever nod to Lawrence High School in the name of a fictitious downtown bar.
Oh,
the
you
Lions
saw that.
Pride.
Thank you. I did name it for LHS.
How much fun is it to write a story set up in the town where you grew up?
Well, it was a lot of fun to put in those little local flourishes. And then I love really good espresso, and Lawrence has an amazing number of good coffee bars. And my personal favorite is the Bourgeois Pig. But I was told early in my career never to use the name of a real place if you were setting action there, because you may think that you're writing favorably about them, but they may not think that. So I created my own place called the Decadent Hippo, which they sell t-shirts that shows a big pink hippo sitting in a cappuccino mug or cup. And that's where VI goes for her morning coffee, and then she goes there at night to drink whiskey. And this is something where she travels down here with her golden retriever, Peppy. Her current lover, Jake, the bass player, he's not happy with her because he's just tired of being in love with someone who's always putting herself at such high physical risk. And he's gone off to Switzerland with his music group, and he wants VI to come. He wants her to take a break and, you know, try to change her life, do something new, do something more fun, more adventurous. And she's always... And she says no, she's insulted and hurt that he doesn't think her work is worthwhile. But she's always making these snide remarks under her breath about, well, I could be in Basel, Switzerland right now eating hand-knit chocolates. But my publisher didn't want hand-knit chocolates, but it's the only way, I think, the only word that describes your obsession with perfect locavore, artisanal, organic. It's all, someone is sitting there just carefully hand-knitting it all. Anyway, so she's down here with her dog, Peppy, and the Decadent Hippo, she says, would you believe that she was an emotional support animal? And they say, oh, sure. It's November. It's chilly. It's spitting rain half the time.
What does bringing the dog along do for VI that she couldn't do on her own?
I'm not sure why in the beginning I had her bring the dog. It just seemed too lonely to me to be coming here on her own. Mr. Contreras, her downstairs neighbor who's in his 90s, he's gone off to the Virgin Islands with I think it's a niece, maybe it's a cousin. Isn't that terrible that I can't remember now what I myself wrote?
I think it was a niece.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah, his wife's niece. And so VI is feeling, well, she doesn't need to stay there to look after him. Jake has gone to Switzerland. She's just really lonely. And Peppy will bring her some warmth and comfort. But then as I was working on the book, I'm not someone who does outlining or plots in advance. I know where I want to be, but I don't know how to get there. And so there's a lot of writing, discarding. And there's this famous line from Chekhov that if you have a gun on the mantle in Act 1, it has to be used in Act 3. So halfway through, I thought, well, Peppy's here. That means that she has to play a role. And so I have her play a very dramatic role that I'm not going to describe because that really is a spoiler.
I think also the presence of the dog grounds VI in giving her, she's off solving a crime, but she also has this being that she needs to attend to. And it's kind of this reminder that, oh, right, I can't just go off hunting for, you know, these missing people. I need to walk the dog, or I need to figure out what to do with the dog. The dog's been in the car too long. And it's kind of this constant grounding her in the real world of responsibilities that of a more personal nature. And it also gives her someone to talk to.
Right. She and Peppy have intense conversations, as I do with my dog. But that I'm glad it strikes you that way. I always worry that there's just a little bit too much dog in my books. And of course, I do have a couple of friends who don't like dogs. Hard as it is to believe that, I personally have friends who do not like dogs. They were so happy when, in one book, Lottie doesn't particularly want the dogs around and makes them stay out of her apartment. And they were cheering when Lottie firmly drew a line against dog presence.
You and V.I. Warshawski have been companions for 35 years now. How has she changed over the years? And is it hard to keep her fresh?
One of the things that has changed with her, well, there have been a number of changes, but when I started the series, I had the idea that she should age in real time, because who she is really a product of the social justice movements of the 60s and 70s, and also who she is shaped by her mother's experience of being a refugee or an immigrant. Back before we had so many legal hair-splitting ideas of what a refugee was, her mother fled from the race laws in Mussolini's Italy and ended up in Chicago, and that also had a profound effect on who V.I. was. But as time has passed, and I was 30 when I started the series, or in my early 30s, and I couldn't imagine that I'd be the age I am now, and I couldn't imagine what my body would feel like, and I don't do I don't do 5% of the things with my body that VI does with hers. But she's much more robust than I am physically, that's for sure. But even so, I decided for her to stay active at the level that I want her to be, her aging has slowed way down. So I was 34 when I started, and I'm 69 now. VI was 30 when I started, and she's 50 now. So she's better than I am in so many ways, including not needing to age as quickly as I do. I think one of the things that I cannot seem to get a handle on is that she was a lot more insouciant when I started the series. And I'm someone who is hyper-responsible, and I don't like being hyper-responsible, but I am. And, constantly worrying about this person's welfare and needing to take care of that cause or program. And I think my worrying has bled over into VI in a way that I don't like, but I, especially because it's a first-person narrative, it's really hard for me to draw a line and make her a more carefree, thumbing her nose kind of person.
Is she more like what you would like to be?
Is she more like what I would like to be? I feel that there are risks that I am hoping I will take before I get too decrepit to keep writing, that there are risks with my writing that I don't take, and she really will jump off that high dive. There are many aspects of her life that I don't admire or wish to emulate, but that's the one that I think that's my desideratum, the thing that I wish was true for me.
One of my favorite scenes in Fallout is one in which she's describing just going about her day and how much of the day that she's spending changing clothes. She's in jeans and a turtleneck, and then she puts on her, her professional suit, and then she throws on a sweatshirt and goes out for a run. And once I noticed that, I really started noticing VI spends a lot of time changing clothes.
And fortunately, these are 21st century clothes. I read a memoir about, it was a book that came out about a decade ago, a memoir that this man wrote about his family in Austria before the Second World War. They collected netsuki, I'm not going to say it right, but the tiny Japanese carvings. And that was all that was left of their sort of enormous personal fortune and art collection after the Nazis were through with them. But he describes his maternal grandmother's day changing clothes, and she had affairs. And these clothes, you needed a maid to button and unbutton everything. So it really took hours. And then if she was going to, so she would keep a duplicate outfit where she was having the affair, just so that she didn't have to spend so much time. Now I can't remember why a duplicate outfit would cut time from the dressing. And never mind. But at least with VI and people like me, it can take you under 5 minutes to throw it all off and throw it all on again, and which is what I did before I came down to the studio. I looked at myself in the mirror. I thought, I know this is radio, but I can't look quite so much like I just crawled out of a dumpster.
You look smashing, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to an encore broadcast of my conversation with novelist Sarah Paretsky from March 2018. I asked her to finish out our interview with an excerpt from her 18th V.I. Warshawski novel, Fallout.
So I'm just going to read a little bit. V.I. has discovered a dead body in an old farmhouse, not unlike the house that I used to live in, and at a location not dissimilar to where my family home, still called the Gilmore House for the family that lived there before we bought it. And she is back in Lawrence with the sheriff, whose name is Gisborne, and he is named for the sheriff of Nottingham, whose name was Gisborne. And he is talking to her. So this is not based on any real Douglas County sheriff. So please do not be offended that the sheriff is a little bit confrontational with my heroine. Everyone is confrontational with her because she's confrontational.
I was just going to say, before we get to feeling too sorry for VI, she dishes it out and she as well as she takes it.
Marilyn Stasio reviewed Fallout for the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and she said, not VI, but that I was fierce with a chip on my shoulder. And I thought, well, Marilyn, you're probably right. And that's probably why VI is fierce with a chip on her shoulder. So she's found this dead woman in my family home. She's found the daughter of a KU faculty member who's living on the streets, passed out under a iron stairwell at the Lion's Pride Bar at 8th and Rhode Island. And local law enforcement officers are just starting to wonder, the local Lawrence police officer that she works with, whose name is Everard, says, are you cause or effect, Warshawski, the way the bodies are piling up around you? So the dog persuaded you to enter, the sheriff said when we were back in town, and you turned on the lights, even at the risk of tampering with the crime scene. I had my temper on a lead as tight as the one I'd kept on Peppy. A rat about as big as your size 13s was nibbling on the victim's nose. It seemed disrespectful to keep the lights on, not to let the vermin do any more damage than they already had. The sheriff kept asking questions, but they were time markers, just to show that he was in charge. Why was I in Kansas? Why had I gone to the McKinnon farm? Why had I gone into the house? None of it was relevant, but Gisborne wanted to know why it was I who had found Sonia Keel, what I'd said to Randy Marks at St. Raphael's, the group home where Sonia lived. Sheriff, I interrupted. A Buick Enclave has been showing up around me off and on today. I wondered how you knew I'd been to see Mr. Marks, so I thought perhaps you were following me. I'm not, but maybe I should, the way you're stirring the waters, Gisborne said. Marks called me. You're in a small town now, Warshawski, not the big city. We all know each other. We all look out for each other. You may think you're moving around stealthily, but everyone knows where you are and what you eat for breakfast. Well, that's good. If you decide to lock me up, you'll know just what to bring me. I'd forgotten I wasn't going to bait him. Since you're on me like my underwear, you know I was at the hospital. Did you know that neither of Sonia Keel's parents has been to see their near-dead daughter? That's just what I mean, Warshawski, Gisborne said heavily. You don't know squat about these people. Sonia forfeited her right to parental regard a long time ago. I nodded slowly, as if he'd said something particularly meaningful. Before she passed out, Sonia said she'd seen Emerald Faring in the place where Matt Chastain lies buried. Where is that? Gisborne's eyes darted around the interrogation room as if a good answer might be posted on one of the walls next to the "Don't spit or smoke in here" signs. If those friends of yours were staying out at Doris McKinnon's farm, you need to get them in here to answer questions about her murder. Sheriff, I said gently, number one, I've never met them. They're not my friends. I'm here in your county looking for them. Number two, this means you've identified the body and the means of death already, which is massively impressive. I'm going to get the Cook County Medical Examiner to phone your pathologist so he can find out how you did this in 3 hours. I'll put it out on my Twitter feed. That is not for public consumption. His phone rang, sparing us both further escalation. He picked it up, snapped his name into the mouthpiece, but put it against his chest while he told me not to leave his jurisdiction. Must not bait the sheriff. Must not bait the sheriff, I chanted to myself. Oh, I wouldn't dream of it, Sheriff. I'm having way too much fun here.
That's Sarah Paretsky reading from Fallout. It's her 18th V.I. Warshawski novel. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you, Kay, for your interest. I really appreciate it. How about if I give a plug for supporting your local radio station?
Go.
Hi, this is Sarah Paretsky. I live in Chicago now, but I grew up in Lawrence. I'm a donor to Kansas Public Radio, and I hope you will be too.
You heard it from Sarah Paretsky. Support Kansas Public Radio and locally produced programs like KPR Presents. You can donate online at kansaspublicradio.org. While you're there, check out Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War. Kansas Public Radio was one of 12 organizations across the state that collected oral histories of Vietnam vets for this project. If you missed last week's broadcast of KPR Presents, it's now archived at our website, kansaspublicradio.org. You can also listen to interview excerpts and see photos of the veterans who took part in this project. If you have your own memories of the Vietnam War, share them on KPR's Facebook page. Kansas Stories of the Vietnam War is sponsored by Humanities Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.